Good morning. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fourth Division, the Honorable Justice Jesse G. Reyes presiding. Case number 19-2294, People versus Antoine Elliott.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Good morning. Apologize for the delay. The previous matter went a little bit longer than we anticipated, but we're ready to proceed. Today with this case and with counsel who are going to be arguing, please identify yourselves for the record and the party that you're representing.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Brian Carroll from the State Appellate Defender's Office for Mr. Elliott.
Good morning, Susan Wabakind, Assistant State's Attorney on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Okay, great. All right, so 15 minutes apiece. Appellant, you want some time for rebuttal?
Or is there 4 minutes?
4 minutes. All right, you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honors.
Okay, please do so.
Okay. I'll be addressing just the first issue, the ineffective assistance issue, but if Your Honors have any questions on the sentencing issue, I'll be happy to answer those as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So Mr. Elliott's trial counsel was ineffective for failing to call an expert on eyewitness identification to bolster his misidentification defense. And in turn, his post-trial counsel was ineffective for failing to raise trial counsel's ineffectiveness in Mr. Elliott's motion for new trial. So the trial counsel's entire theory of defense was that this was a case of misidentification. Therefore, it was critical for counsel to undermine the state's eyewitnesses' identifications of Mr. Elliott. And as Illinois courts have recognized, expert testimony on eyewitness identifications can go a long way in undermining eyewitness identifications by explaining to the trier of fact, in this case a jury, that how people's common sense ideas on witnesses' abilities to perceive and recall incidents are not necessarily sensical. That ideas such as the stress of the situation, presence of the weapon, and lesser ability to recognize strangers can all affect the reliability of an eyewitness's identification.
Counsel, let me ask you, on trial counsel made the decision not to call the expert. Wasn't it just trial strategy?
Well, Your Honor, one, we don't know on this record whether he made the conscious decision to or just failed to. But even assuming it was a trial strategy, only sound trial strategy is entitled to deference. And in this case, where Mr. Elliott's defense rose and or fell on whether or not the jury gave credit to Tiffany's identification of him, it was not sound. It would not be sound trial strategy to not call an expert. Like, even though counsel did hammer on issues with her testimony during closing arguments aren't evidence, whereas a expert's testimony would be evidence that the jury would could consider and it would just be a much stronger case. It would hammer down the issues with Tiffany's identification. Like, she herself acknowledged what high stress she was under. She was, she said her main concern was the safety of her son. She kept looking, switching back and forth, looking forward, looking back at her son. And when confronted with discrepancies between what she told the police immediately after the incident and her trial testimony, her explanation was what stress she was under at the time. And an expert would be able to hammer that home to the jury and make a much stronger case, and thus make it at least a reasonable probability that the jury would have reached a different outcome.
Mr. Carroll, you are just attacking him for not calling an expert regarding the female who identified your client. You're not attacking him for not calling an expert for Mr. Figueroa, who testified that he knew him, that he was in a gang with Mr. Figueroa's brother on a previous occasion, that he gave the defendant's name to the police immediately at the scene, and that he identified the defendant's photographs. So I want to know, assuming that he could have or should have called an expert, where is the prejudice in your client's case when, if he called an expert, first the state could call an expert. And when we look at the bigger factors and the factors that the experts look at, like gun focus, this case is not, a case where this young lady first had gun focus. She says she sees the defendant arguing with people. She gets out of, unless I'm wrong, she gets out of her car. So she doesn't even know he has a gun. He's arguing and she's looking at him. She thinks there's going to be a fight. So she gets back into her car. Then she sees him not pointing the gun at her, at the car behind her, but pointing the gun toward the people on the sidewalk and starts to fire. She has her kid turn away. And then after she turns back, the defendant's standing in front of her, looking her eye to eye, face to face, and the gun's down by his side. And so when I look at the bigger factors, you add that to the fact that she, I think, identified him in a lineup 7 days later. She gave a, according to the record, an accurate pretty accurate description of height, weight, clothing. Where is the prejudice to the defendant? Also given the testimony of Mr. Figueroa, and I'm not going to repeat all of the, cell phone data that connects him. Could we possibly get a different result, even if it was error for him not to call an expert?
Well, in terms of the bigger factor, an expert would be able to explain to the jury how, you know, a witness is, you know, perceived degree of attention, their certainty in their identification and whatnot, is affected by the stress of situations. And so we give them a better idea of how to weigh the bigger factors. And in some ways showing how the bigger factors are not as, you know, that the science shows that the bigger factors are not the most accurate measure of the reliability of an eyewitness. And also in this case, yes, you know, she testified, she got out of her car before the shooting started. She says she looked him straight in the eye. But there's also inconsistencies with what she saw and what the other witnesses said. That, you know, she said, oh, he was wearing a hat. Other witnesses, he was wearing a hoodie. People said he was shooting in the street. Other witnesses said he was in the parkway. So there are inconsistencies showing that, despite her description of the situation, her recall or her perception and recall of the situation is not as entirely accurate as she, you know, may believe. In terms of Jose's testimony, again, he's biased. I think that was the reason initial counsel on this case didn't include him in someone who would be attacked by the expert witness. That his gang bias would affect his credibility. And he also had some issues in his testimony. He claimed that there was no car behind the shooter's car. And if Tiffany came out of the car was behind and she actually got out and wanted was yelling saying that she wanted to get around them, the fact that he didn't mention that at all in his testimony is fairly suspect. So I think yes, there is still prejudice that Tiffany.
You think there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different, given yes. all of the other evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then, any other questions from the justice?
I would ask you this, Mr. Carroll, follow up on a question that Justice Reyes had asked a little earlier. The court is to give a strong presumption that counsel was engaging in trial strategy. And you made a comment, I wrote the comment down. You said you didn't know, and I'll paraphrase, you didn't know, you couldn't make that assumption based on this record. But it seems to me that it's your client's burden to show that this was not sound trial strategy, that the presumption is that it is sound trial strategy. So if you're unable to do that on this record, does that not make Mr. Elliott's argument a little difficult to sustain?
No, just to clarify my position, I'm saying we can't determine whether it was a strategic decision or a failure to investigate, but
don't we have to necessarily do that?
I don't think, no, Your Honor, because even if it's strategic, I think under these facts, it would be a unsound decision. Like whether it's strategic or not, the question is, it was not a sound decision. So I think despite the fact that we can't make that as it's strategic or not, what we can say is that if it was strategic, it was still not sound given the facts of this case. So, unless your justices have any other questions, I just ask that this court reverses Mr. Elliott's convictions and remand for a new trial pursuant to issue one, or remand for resentencing under.
Mr. Carroll, I apologize. I do have one further question.
Oh, sorry.
On the sentencing issue, in as much as your client was sentenced in 2019, and he is eligible for parole, does that not negate his Miller-based argument?
Well, just to clarify, we're not making a straight-up Miller proportional penalties argument. We're just arguing that it was excessive given this case.
I see.
And while Miller and its line of cases don't control in this case, they do their analysis and the science it's based on are they can inform the court's decision.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Carroll.
Yeah.
Just Lampkin, any other questions? Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Okay. Ms. Wobbekind?
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, Susan Wobbekind on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. Your Honors, as defense counsel has stated, the record is absolutely silent as to counsel's reasons for not calling the expert witness. We don't know how much he investigated this. We don't know what even an expert would have testified to, and certainly don't know the effect that any imaginary testimony would have on the jury's verdict. So as to the first, and so for these, And bearing in mind too, that the counsel's decision whether or not to call the expert was a matter of trial strategy, he's entitled to a very strong presumption that it was sound. So as to that first prong, defendant has not shown any reason to find that counsel's decision was not sound. And in fact, counsel was entitled to determine that calling the expert would not be as strong for their case as he is attacking the witnesses' credibilities and identifications through argument and cross and recross examination, which he did very, very strenuously. So the fact that counsel's strategy was ultimately not successful, and even the fact that perhaps an expert would have helped his case, doesn't make that strategy unsound. It just makes it unsuccessful. And I touched a little bit as to the adversarial testing, and counsel, you know, did not touch on that. But as I said, trial counsel tested and retested this case in numerous ways. So we certainly don't have a failure to conduct any adversarial testing. And then Justice Lampkin was asking about prejudice as to that second prong. Again, we have no evidence as to what an expert would have testified. So how can we say that that expert would have swayed the jury's verdict in any way? And then on top of that, we do have Jurassic's identification was very strong and it did meet all those five Biggers factors. It was corroborated by Figueroa's testimony and the physical evidence and the cell phone evidence. And it's highly unlikely that an expert would have undermined her reliability and the reliability of her identification in any significant way. But as I said, we also did have the other evidence. We had the evidence that Giovanni and defendant belonged to rival gangs. And although that did in some way, I'll just touch on Jose Figueroa's testimony, since I'm talking about the gang evidence, although that could have undermined Figueroa's reliability, it also goes to motive in this case. So it hurts defendant as much as it would hurt Figueroa. So it's pretty much moot at that point. We have the evidence that they were the rival gangs. We have the evidence that Giovanni was shot with a 40 caliber weapon. We have Jose Figueroa's identification testimony that he had an unobstructed view of the shooter who he recognized from previous interactions as defendant. He knew all the specifics of defendant's gang rivalries. He knew his previous nickname as a Latin brother. He knew his new nicknames as a Milwaukee King. And then he identified him in a photo array the day of the shooting. And then his testimony, although, you know, perhaps there were inconsistencies that that's going to happen between different people. But his main story of how everything went down did corroborate Jurassic's testimony, was corroborated by Lucha Ferrara's testimony, which defendant has said we should listen to. And although she didn't identify anybody, her version of events does significantly line up with the other two witnesses. So taking that into account, that lends to the credibility of the identification witnesses. And then also we have the cell phone evidence showing that defendant wanted to buy 40 caliber bullets the day before the shooting, was in a stash room because of an emergency within hours after the shooting, was in possession of a gun the day after the murder, sent texts explaining his gang status and his nicknames and his previous nicknames, bragged that he was a royal killer. And royal, I don't know, I don't think I did say the Sin City Royals, I'm gonna get that wrong, but Royal was the name of the gang that Figueroa was in. And defendant was bragging that he was a royal killer. He sent a screenshot of an article about the shooting saying royal down, performed numerous Facebook and internet searches on the phone, searching for the victims' names and shootings in the area. He had a tremendous amount of interest in this shooting and knew that it was a royal who had been shot, a royal who was killed hours after the murder, which certainly was a lot of information to have when the investigation was ongoing. And then as to the prejudice prong, again, we can't even say that he was prejudiced. Oh no, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the prejudice, I'm sorry. And because of this, because of all that evidence, we can't say that even had Jurassic's identification been undermined, that the defendant was prejudiced, that the verdict would have been different. We have all this other evidence against him. And defendant simply has not given that affirmative evidence that would have happened. So for these reasons, We ask that the court reject defendant's ineffective assistance of counsel, trial counsel claim. And then for the same reasons, we ask that you reject the ineffective assistance of post-trial claim, because post-trial can't be faulted for raising this meritless claim. If you have no questions, I can quickly touch on the sentencing issue if you'd like, or.
Yeah, please proceed.
Okay, sure. So as to the sentencing issue, defendant's sentence is presumed proper because it was within the statutory range. And trial counsel is also presumed to have considered all of the mitigating evidence and other factors that were presented to him during the sentencing hearing. Defendant has to offer some affirmative evidence that the trial court did not properly consider these factors in order to overcome this presumption of properness. His reiteration of the mitigating factors and the length of the sentence does not overcome that presumption. And in fact, Judge Sachs's decision is very explicit as to the factors that he considered. He said he considered the PSA, the lawyer's arguments, defendant's childhood, the fact that defendant was not abused, that he was an A and B student, an athlete in high school, that he had a job, that he had relationships with his child's mother. And then he also touched on the potential for rehabilitation. The fact that he said he considered the PSI gives that presumption that he did do so anyway. But then he also went through and said, he talked about defendant's priors, talked about the fact that he was convicted for an unlawful possession of a 40 caliber gun, the same type used in the shooting, after the murder took place. And he did listen to defendant's statements and allocution, but rejected a lot of defendant's claims. He didn't believe that defendant had quit the gang. He said he disagreed with defendant's statement that he was remorseful and felt bad for his actions. And he based that on the fact that defendant had sent all those texts, you know, bragging about the shooting, the fact that there were numerous photos on that phone of defendant with guns and flashing gang signs. And the fact that defendant was arrested with a 40 caliber gun after the murder. He didn't feel so remorseful that he turned his life around after he killed this 16-year-old boy. He was still, you know, continuing in his ways. And then finally, the court took into account the fact that defendant was totally in control at the time he chose to shoot this 16-year-old boy, and that he shot this boy for no other reason than that he belonged to a different gang than defendant. And that statement that defendant was totally in control goes to defendant's argument about age. First of all, just because the court didn't mention age, as I said, he read the PSI, so he's presumed to have taken everything in that PSI into consideration. The court also defense counsel mentioned defendant's age during the hearing. The court mentioned defendant's birth date and the date of the arrest during his sentencing. So he's presumed, again, that presumption that I first talked about comes into play. He's presumed to have considered it. And the fact that the court said defendant was in control when he did that shooting, that goes against a lot of these age-based arguments that defendant is now claiming. Defendant didn't have any of that impetuousness of youth or no control and all those other issues. No, the court found, no, he was in control when he did this. He was not under any limitations because of his youth, where, you know, he was 20 years old, 1 month away from turning 21. He was not very young. For those reasons, the record affirmatively refutes defendant's claim that the trial court abused its discretion, and we ask that you affirm defendant's convictions and sentence. And then we rest on our brief.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? No?
Okay. No questions.
All right, thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Going back to the first issue, the ineffective assistance, in terms of what I acknowledge, we don't have any like a report from an expert just saying like what an expert would testify to. However, Illinois courts, like in Lerma and Allen, they're cited in Elliott's brief, the courts recognize what the current science says about eyewitness testimony. So we have some clue of what kind of evidence would be presented by an expert. And in terms of the text messages of Elliott, the state says he's bragging about being a royal killer. If I'm correct, the text messages saying "we royal killer" is plural, which that's just showing that his gang is royal killer, which is not in dispute. And again, the fact that he knows about that a royal was killed, where it happened. I mean, he's in the gang. It's not in dispute, and it would be, reasonable for him to want to know what's going on with his gang. So the fact that he's doing searches and whatnot is not direct evidence of his guilt. He never once explicitly stated that he committed this crime. For sentencing, Elliott's going to be 90 years old when he gets out. So assuming he lives that long, which is quite an assumption to make.
Can I just interrupt you? I think that was Justice Martin's question. You said he'll be 90 when he gets out because he got a 70-year sentence. But statute says that if he's under 21, no matter what sentence he gets, he still will be eligible for parole after serving 20 years. So, and there's case law that says I think it's 40 years is, yeah. Over 40 is, it violates it for a juvenile, he's not a juvenile, yeah. But isn't he eligible for parole in 20 years? So he could actually get out at 40
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor, but still in this case, I believe the nature of the case, this was a reckless, impulsive shooting. No indication it was a long, premeditated attack. The trial court put a lot of emphasis on the pictures on social media of him flashing guns and stuff. And again, that's just stupid thing young people do. That the things that the court trial court focused on were things that are that again, like Miller, while it's not controlling, it is instructive on these are the type of reckless, not thought out behaviors of a young person. And I think it doesn't properly reflect his rehabilitative potential. And because of that, even if he's eligible for parole, I think this, given this case, the 70-year sentence is excessive. So unless Justice, if any other questions, I'll just
any other questions?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, counsels. We'll take the case under advisement and be rendering a decision shortly. At this point in time, since there are no other questions, this court is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.